Continuing with Ryle on 19th, August 76. So, about the other groups, which other groups?
Well, we used to obviously have quite close contact with the Central Bank, meeting with RES meetings and the like. I suppose we probably met up with the French, I forget when the first sort of international meeting was, probably 1950 or so, and then from then onwards there was quite a lot of contact with the French. Mm.
Were you reading their stuff in Compton-Lou?
Yes, I think so, yes. And I'm sure we were aware of the NRL work. 54, I went there.
Oh, by that time, yes. But I'm thinking of in the 40s. Yes. There wasn't very much, but they did a few things. But it sounds like it was not terribly influencing what you were doing. You were just...
Oh, no, I didn't think it did. I think we were all going along what we thought we could do and just getting on with it.
Right.
And that's the way that I suspect science often ought to go.
Rather than worrying about what the other fellow was going.
Yes. Jumping on the latest bandwagon.
What about with optical astronomers? Could you tell me what sort of contact you had with them in those days?
Well, we had quite a lot of contact with our own... at that time, the von Kluver, I think he was here then. But anyway, there was quite a strong active solar group in the observatories here. Trying to correlate the bursts with sunspot and flare activity was certainly going on.
And who were the people there that...
Well, I think, I'm not sure when von Kluver was there as early as 48, but certainly there were people, Stratton, I suppose, was the director then.
Mm-hmm. I think he was. That's all right. I can check that. But who, did these ever come to anything? Anything useful information come out of these correlations of optical and radio?
Well, I mean, I think they probably, I don't know how sure the correlation between radio bursts and optical was at that time. They probably did help in that. Because, as I say, because the sun doesn't always shine in Cambridge, but on the occasion when it did, then we were used to trying to compare the observations.
Mm-hmm. Now, once again, relative to optical astronomers, in April 49, you gave a talk at an RAS meeting talking about a part of what was to become the 1C survey, namely that you had found 23 radio sources and they were unresolved and so forth, positions of plus or minus degree or somewhat better in some cases. How did optical astronomers receive this? You were talking at their society, so, but was it just something that was entirely outside anything they could ever work on?
I think, obviously, there was interest, but I don't think it really could have been much more than that, simply because if you can only tell them where to look to a degree, and it isn't something as obvious as the Sun or the Crab Nebula, then what are you to do about it?
Yeah.
I mean, a degree is a rather large bit of sky. And of course it went on a long time like this. They didn't, I think, feel that there was anything much they could do about these funny things. They had to go away if they waited.
But
that's a little unfair.
Right. But still, I mean, there's a fantastic amount of energy that's being produced in these cases.
Well, one didn't know anything about energy because you didn't know the distance.
Well, that's true.
They could be quite local.
But even
things.
If they were local stars, you had to make them be super suns. I mean,
it had to be much more energy than comes out of the sun in radio, but not out of the sun in total energy. I mean, the actual total energy problem wasn't very, very severe.
That's true.
It was just the sun happened to be a particularly feeble source. I mean, that was the interpretation, I think.
Right. It really wasn't until the Cygnus A and so forth that
they got the distances. Right. Yes. And see, even the Australian identification of MH7 and the crab, I think everybody, possibly I think us as well, weren't all that convinced by the identification. I mean, okay, they fitted within a degree or so, but and they were unusual objects, rare objects. But, you know, if that had been the case, perhaps one would have ought to have seen some other supernovae. So, you know, even at that time, although fairly soon it was evident that it was right, because everybody got better positions, but even the first announcement of that, I think probably the optical astronomers took it with a pinch of salt.
Right. And you say you did also?
I think we did originally, yes.
Even for the crowd? I find that surprising.
Well, because you didn't know how remarkable the crowd was, not the optical astronomers. I mean, yeah. Okay, nowadays, I mean, somebody said, probably one of the Burbage, there's two sorts of astronomy is the crowd and everything else.
Right.
But I mean, okay, we know that now, because we know a lot about the crowd, but yeah. At that stage, we didn't know anything about it, except it was a little fuzzy thing on the photograph.
Yeah. Well, along the same line, can I ask you, what did you consider that you were doing in the nature of a science? Did you consider that you were doing ionospheric physics extended to outside the ionosphere, or something that we would call radio astronomy or radio physics?
I think radio astronomy. I'm not sure. I think we invented the term, incidentally. And certainly, I consulted my father about the propriety of mixing up Greek and Latin terms.
I see.
At the occasion for the 1950 when I wrote the Physical Society, Portrait of Progress in Physics, really, right. Whatever it's called. The question was, that I think was the time that the term radio astronomy was used in a sort of a definitive way.
Right.
And my father said it was all right to mix up Greek and Latin derived.
There's probably a lot of other examples. So in any case, you did definitely think that you were becoming astronomers.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
So what about this term radiophysicist, which I've heard used quite a bit?
Well, radiophysics is a term which has been used for quite a time, I think, which includes ionospheric physics and then tropospheric propagation physics, all these things. It's a much broader term than, I mean, the Australians were in a radiophysics laboratory, because, I mean, that's right. They converted their radar research group into a thing which was studying all these things, which was definitely concerned with propagation, tropospheric propagation, troposcatter things, and all those things which developed out of it. As well as ionosphere.
Mm-hmm. Something else that you just brought to mind is, I'd be very interested in your opinion on why it was that radio astronomy did not take off in the States like it did here and in Australia. You had the same sort of thing, you know, tremendous radar push during the war, and at the end you had all these trained people and all this surplus equipment.
I think, myself, I believe the difference to be the way that radar development happened. It was, I think, a fantastic occurrence to a young chap to get into radar research in England. Now, as I say, there were maybe 200 of us at the beginning of the war, and the number of fields where radar had obvious applications was extremely broad, and so you found yourself with the responsibility for really a rather surprisingly large amount of this for one's age.
Right.
And, you know, even two or three years later, you'd find young people two or three years after, well, not even a proper degree, because it had only been a 1 or 2 year course, running groups of 25 people in,
yeah,
resulting in a great field.
Right.
Now, that was a way of growing up, a feeling of responsibility, what was possible. You know, all by myself, I will build this great thing with the help of some engineering boys, but I mean, a lot of your own work, sawing up bits of brass tube, and you'll build something as a prototype and try it, and then maybe apply it. Or this was a sort of a way of growing up, which is really a most fantastic thing to happen to anybody. Now, in America, the war situation was different. You came in a much more organized way. Most of the work was done in large existing laboratories, many of them commercial ones. You had no contact day by day, mm-hmm, between the operational people, the RAF that was flying your stuff,
right,
the operational needs, what was possible. There was no interaction of whereby a young chap with a couple of years physics training and a couple, mm-hmm, of years of messing around and employing a bit of brass tube could tell an Air Vice Marshal that was a bloody silly thing to do, he wants to do it like this.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have that, you see. Somebody high up in the Air Force wrote a specification for equipment, which then went out and presumably had bids from all these places.
Yep, yep.
And then it was put through like an ordinary production run. And that was, there was no way in which the young people had this direct contact with operational flying. And I think that it was this contact with, as it were, life in the raw,
right,
being able to talk to the people that were going to be flying and be killed in these machines, that made one grow up fast.
Hmm.
And I think that probably is this feeling that one had a training which would give one confidence to one can do things, rather than saying, well, we can now write a specification for radio telescope.
right.
and get a bid for it, and in due course it'll come.
Right.
I mean, if you want to be nasty, you'd say, that's what happened to the 600-foot sugar grove, you see. That was that was designed by a lot of people, none of them who were young enough.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. Yeah. Although, of course, the sugar growth thing was not really for science, and that was sort of tacked on to placate Congress. But there are other examples. One could think of. That's indeed very interesting.
There was this huge difference in cost, too. The only way Redstone was going to go around this country was if a small university group with a few people in it could scrounge enough bits and pieces and do something. Well, that never seemed to happen in America. Much too soon, you leapt to the idea of a national observatory.
Yeah.
And that was a great mistake.
Well, even before then, though.
Yes, and I don't know why I didn't start to get off the ground before then. But Hendrik van der Holst and I were invited over, by the ISF to talk about the formation of the national observatory. And we both came out stronger. The one conclusion we reached and put forward to them most forcefully was that they must get cracking now with small university groups to train people and to decide what was wanted, what was going to be the instruments that mattered. But they completely, I mean, they didn't ignore it. They said, no, that is not the way we're going to go about it. I said, well, what are you going to do about the astronomers, the great astronomers, when you've got your equipment? He says, we'll always be able to attract enough people from Europe, you see. Now, that was an admission. It wasn't so much a defeat as that was the cheapest way of doing it, you
right.
see. And that shocked both of us, actually.
Hmm. Who was the other person?
Hendrik van der Holst.
I see, yes. Very interesting.
Some of these remarks are libelous, aren't they?
Well, anything that I might want to quote you, I will certainly ask your permission. Henry Palmer yesterday made the interesting remark to me that he thought that science, or virtually anything, was best done in groups of sort of 10. 5 was a bit too small, 20 was a bit too big, and I guess you would agree with this.
I think probably I would put it a bit bigger than that, simply because I think it's important to have more than one thing going on. I think one thing is done by 5 people.
That's what he was talking about.
But I think I myself was always thought 50 as the right size for a research group. So you've got a number of different lines going on which can interact and help each other.
Right.
But the group itself, I agree, is about 5. But I think we're too big here, actually. We've got 8 or something. But
yeah.
I think 50 is about right, yes.
Okay.
And independence is important. I'm a great disbeliever in national institutions.
Yeah. well, and also in this independence, it seems to me that Radcliffe must have given you an virtually completely independent hand.
Yes, obviously he helped us an enormous amount, but he didn't want to interfere with the way we were going. We were very small, of course. We were only sort of 20% of the group as a whole.
In the beginning?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. I mean, he saw that, or perhaps saw that, I don't know, perhaps saw more things happen this way.
Could you believe you on your own? Well, let's go back to science, and I think the next thing, indeed, is that you obviously got fascinated with these radio sources, having picked up a couple with this thing that was lashed together, and then what was the next step?
Well, I think as soon as we realized that the signal wasn't unique, there was another one of them, we then built this long Michelson instrument, which, there it is, which now had just about enough resolving power so that you could recognize the central maximum. Whatever it was, 10-1 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was in two stages, and we doubled it after a time because we wanted more gain, and we weren't always able to recognize the central maximum. But it still seemed, I'll go back a step. It was evident from this that on the first morning, that what a funny thing, that periodicity is different from that. You see, we hadn't realized that here was a way of measuring
declination
until it actually appeared.
I see, very interesting.
So it was clear that you can get both coordinates from a system with no resolution in the north-south direction.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that had advantages because you didn't have any moving structures. This is an incredibly cheap thing. And you could measure declinations moderately accurate, except with low decks, as with all these things. And therefore you get coordinates out in straight away.
And who was it that actually worked on the building of this? The three of you?
Chap Paul Rao, Chap Paul Smith, and Chap Paul Ellesmore, as far as I recall.
Okay.
No, we had an assistant.
Well, I'm asking just in order to get a feel for what the operational style was. You had an idea that you wanted to do something like this, and basically the three of you went out and built the thing, or?
Yes, virtually. There's quite a pile of angle iron needed, so we ordered that from the longer down the road and got him to chop them off the right leg and drill the holes in it because we didn't have a power drill. And then we put them in the ground and poured the concrete ground and put the dipoles up. We've got a whole lot of insulator support also from an old German radar, which posts with dielectric tops.
Mounted
dipoles on.
Now, this paper was submitted in August 50, but the observations were carried out when? Over the previous year or 2 years? Or
how? Oh, no, it wouldn't have been that long. I can't remember when that was built exactly.
What is this?
See,
that's since 1948, May is referring to the first array you had for radio sources.
Well, yes, but we also did measure the spectrum. So we built simple instruments on these three wavelengths. But those are much smaller than this. This was a thing with whatever it does, 20 nanometers. So you've got two to keep being.
But what I was wondering is about how long did it take to do this survey?
Oh, so you did one night, you see, with this system.
Well, but in fact, is that what you did? Or?
Well, not practice, no, but I mean, the observations are because it covers the whole sky.
Right.
It's not this definition strips. You do it. I mean, the point really was that the cheapest way of getting gain was to make it long and thin and cover the declination range to avoid the need for rotating it. And as soon as this was evident, that we can measure the declination of the source and material, there was no need to have resolving power this way. And therefore, just to sheer cash, it was the easiest thing, the best thing to do to get.
So in fact, the observations were done in a very short time.
Oh, yes.
You're saying.
Well, I don't imagine the analysis took very long.
And you came out with 50 radio sources. I might ask you, how many might you have expected? Did you have any idea? Of course, Bolton, you knew he had 6 sources. So you knew that there were 6 of his sensitivity level.
Yes, well, I don't think one expected anything. One didn't know anything what was going to happen. Clearly, that you were going to get some. I mean, that I think one knew enough about things to suggest that if you've got 2 or 6, whatever it was, up to distance A, if you go 4 times weaker in flux, you should be able to get whatever it is, 9 times as many sources. I think that sort of sum we could do. But
well, but that still is a presumption, though, that the things are continuing out in an isotropic manner.
Well, of course, the question of whether it's isotropic or not was also very, I think fairly soon after this, we were certainly thinking about the possibility that the galactic background was these things, in which case, of course, you won't expect to see any anisotropy for a long time. There's an awful lot of galactic background to make with these things.
It takes an awful lot of stars.
Yes, and we did some sums on what the space density would have to be to
And what flux density you'd have to get down to before you could detect anisotropy.
Yes, that would have come out as well.
And you weren't expecting it at all here.
No, it was just real. I think probably the point was that the identification that the Australians had made, the lack of identification of the brightest two, which were quite a lot stronger, of course, than the ones they had identified, was one mystery. But clearly, if some had been identified, then you wanted to see what happened if you looked at more.
Right. But now you're talking about radio stars, and yet in the paper you make quite a bit of discussion over coincidences with galaxies. So you must have been also thinking along that line.
Yes,
how did
I think.
Come about?
Well, I mean, of course, the Australians had got M87 was one of them. And as I say, I don't know how seriously we were convinced by it with the accuracy of positions which were then available.
And Centaurus A also.
And Centaurus A, yes, that was. Yes, that was in one of the earliest lists, wasn't it?
Right, that was the three of them came together.
They did, yes, that's right. And clearly, obviously, wants to get as many as one can and see optically what you can find in any of their positions. And at that time, it was 2 extragalactic, 1 galactic. So,
so you really were weather open, even though these were being called radio stars. At this stage, it seems to me.
I don't think we had the connotation of within the galaxy for the word star so much as here was a thing which was a bright point source as distinct from the background radiation.
I see.
And I think people have read too much into the use of the word star in that context. I mean, looking at the radio sky, you've got a great Milky Way and you've got points of light on it. And I think it was just the analogy with optical stars, that one called them stars this early. Although there was this other paper, I forget where it was, when we actually did a sort of a limited row. Was it in the back end of this one?
I don't think so. That was...
Yes.
Maybe it was.
No, it wasn't, because there was a graph. Oh, maybe it was in. Maybe it was in the.
Was that the 2C?
No, I think it was in the. This thing.
The 1950 review.
Yes.
That
thing there. That thing I'm thinking of.
Figure.
N to the minus 3 halves times p should give a straight line. You see if they're uniformly distributed without any falling off anything.
Ah, yes.
And then I think from this we said what would have to happen if you were going to. How near they'd have to be if you were going to explain the background with them.
Right. So, well, that's rather interesting, because I noticed that Edge's thesis, the 3C survey, in 1959, is also called a survey of radio stars.
Yes, I don't think that...
And what you're saying is that there's no no meaning in the interpretation of that except radio source. It really means nothing different.
I think it's meant to imply a compact radio source as opposed to an extended Milky Way.
But... Why was this? It seems confusing to me that this terminology was kept along, if that were the case, because there were, of course, these competing ideas about whether they really were stars or not. And why was there not a neutral term? Of course, I guess eventually...
Well, there was, but I don't think at this time this is really developed, this conflict of views, whether or what not conflict.
Well, by Edge's, no, by 59, certainly.
59?
Yeah, Edge's thesis I'm talking about. It was also titled Radio Stars. I was surprised to see this.
Yeah, we didn't call 3C radio stars, did we?
Not in the paper.
No.
Right, but his thesis is titled.
Well, what he writes is he's not doing me.
Okay.
No, I mean, I think we had, by the way, we did call it sources by the title of 3C.
I'm not sure, but I think that's probably right.
But, I mean, I don't believe he, if he called his thesis that, I don't believe he did it for any particular thing.
Well, no, I asked him that, as a matter of fact, and he said he didn't.
Right? No.
Okay. Let's see, about the 1C survey, let's see, is there anything else that I wanted to... Well, a general question which I want to ask, we're going to have to get to lunch here, is that the 1C, of course, begins a long chain, which is still continuing. We've heard at this conference here about the 6C, so it just keeps on going. When you were developing this and said, well, let's do a survey of the sky, did you realize at all that you would you'd just be wanting to go to fainter and fainter levels, assuming that you got some sources here?
Well, it was obviously dependent on what came out of this. It's also dependent on whether anybody was going to give us any money, because up to now we hadn't had any money, you see. We just bought, literally it was hundreds of dollars,
right.
our annual budget.
Right.
And all this was done on that sort of money, because we got the receiver, X-ray radar receiver, we got the Wurzburgs free. We had to mount them, but we got the structures free, and a lot of the electronics components were free. Obviously, before we went on to the next stage, which is in fact the 2C survey, the big cylindrical parabola structures, there was a lot of money going to be involved, and at this stage there was no knowing whether that sort of money, which clearly was not coming from university funds, would ever be available. It depends on making a good case from what you'd done with your hundreds of dollars. And we did eventually get to some of whatever it was, $11,000 or something, to build the telescope which made the first 2C and 3C surveys.
Was this sort of a breakthrough then, you're saying, in funding in Britain to get this amount of money? There were not precedents for...
Well, there wasn't any money at all. There wasn't any money, full stop. But I forget what time it was when the science, what it was called, the Science Coach Camp, was called the Department of Scientific Industrial Research. They started getting funds for the development of university research. And
it must have been the early 50s or mid-50s.
Yes, thereabouts, early 50s, I suppose. But I mean, the you know, you didn't have great ambitions early on. You just saw what you could do with what you had.
Okay, well, that was the attitude then. But was there any time later on, when the 2C results were beginning to come in, or 3C, that you began to see sort of a 10-20-year plan? I mean, looking back at your career, I mean, one can make a nice case that it all develops very logically, et cetera.
I think
is it fair to say that you saw that beforehand?
I think perhaps the greatest discontinuity, as it were, was with the identification of Cygnus A, because that showed that we were in the cosmology game, for all that Jeff Burbidge says, and will continue to say. Some people's minds are shut. But that, I know, to me, was the sort of point where one said, well, this is now something much more interesting than it might have been. It's much more interesting than there being galactic objects, and much more interesting than being M87s. Here is something which, even with the little instruments of that stage, was quite likely seeing things, if things like Cygnus existed as well as Cygnus, quite likely seeing things as far as a 200 inch.
Right.
This crummy little instrument costing $200, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, now that was a very important thought.
Mm-hmm.
And from then onwards, I think certainly my own involvement in the cosmology game started in 1950-51, whatever it was, was Bardem and Kosky's 200 inch measurements.
Right, 51, yes.
Based on the two Würzburg interferometer positions which Graham Smith got.
Right.
Which were the first ones to get down to a fraction of a minute of arc.
So you think that at that stage it became clear to you that here was something that could really go.
It went right out into extragalactic space in a way which nobody could have foreseen until that observation, Bardem and Kosky's.
And then you mentioned that the funding for the 2C was the first time that you entered the big time as far as funding went, so to speak.
Well, it's the first time we got any money outside the small university, Cavendish Grant,
yes. But I don't think you've still answered whether you could sort of see in your mind's eye over the next 10-15 years that you would be continually pushing to fainter and fainter levels and more sources and so forth.
One thought like that. I mean, I think it was clearly important to get more sources than this could see and get them with better precision. Because here was something which, the further you could go, was back in time.
And so each decision was only made on the basis of the previous few years' experience for the next few years?
I think clearly so, because you didn't know what the next instrument after this was going to show, and until you'd got that, you clearly couldn't design another instrument.
Yeah.
You didn't know what it was wanted to do.
Okay.
I mean, this is what it affects things like sensitivity versus resolving power and all these things. You hadn't a clue how to design the instrument in sheer hard fact, or what frequency it'll work on or anything.
Okay. Well, I think we better get some lunch. So, continuing a couple hours later, I see at the August 50 RAS meeting that Bolton, well, that's independent, but Bolton did talk about Australian results, but you said that some of the refluctuations of the radio sources were ionospheric. It was not clear if some of them might be intrinsic.
Well, that was referring to these things.
Oh, I see.
We were still...
These anomalous bursts.
Yes, there did seem to be something which could only be interpreted in terms of intrinsic.
I see. And we've already mentioned your paper with Tony Hewish in Monthly Notices in 1950 on the...
That was the real proof that it was an ionospheric effect.
Right. And you also measured an actual jitter in the positions of the sources, which I think may have been the first time that was done.
Yes, I think.
Was two or three arc minutes.
Yes, yes. Yes, that was certainly.
Was that done with the two Würzburg dishes?
No, I think not. I think that would have been done. That was working on 210 megahertz. It would have been done at 80, I suspect, or even 38 with a small array which we had.
But one thing I did want to ask you about is that you, in this article, according to the abstract, I haven't actually looked at the article, you talk about interstellar matter being accreted by the sun. Maybe actually what's disturbing the ionosphere as opposed to what we would now call the solar wind, solar particles. And I was wondering why you were thinking that way. What was the objection to solar wind?
There wasn't a solar wind at that time. But people had talked quite a lot about the accretion of interstellar matter by the sun as a form of supply of energy to the corona.
I see.
I think that was the origin of this, and probably that was sort of in full flight at the time. As I can't quite, this is a Bondi, I think.
I see.
And I think the feeling was that, I mean, you measure a million degrees coronal temperature, which of course is about the hydrostatic value you'd have to have for free escape or free fall in. It's the same naturally.
Right.
And therefore, this the coronal temperature distribution tells you no way which the matter is going or the energy is going. And I believe that was probably the sort of reason why.
Yeah. So in other words, the source of the heating for the corona was not understood, and this was one possibility that was being talked about at that time. Yeah. So then, seeing this. Let's see. Your review paper in Reports in Progress in Physics in 1950 is really the first major review of radio astronomy. I wanted to ask you, as you wrote that, if you can try to remember back 25 years, did things seem to be coming together in any sense, or did it just become more confusing as you sat down?
I think obviously there were very few problems solved, but it did seem it was about the right time to write it. I think that there were a number of fields becoming apparent that were obviously going to be interesting, of which obviously the one which what was the most interesting at the time, I think, was the nature of the radio sources. I think it was an important time to put things together.
In what sense? Do you think
enough observations have been made to be able to say something worthwhile about them? Quite a lot of groups have got going by then, quite a lot of different techniques have been developed, and the overall picture was now becoming interesting. There was clearly a future in this game, and it was worthy of a title for its own, which radio astronomy, I think, I coined.
Right. And it was also worthwhile to sit down and say, well, now where do we go from here?
Yes.
We're obviously going to stay in the game. And,
yes.
Something that you did not publish anything with, I don't think, but nevertheless were involved with, of course, is the two Wurzburg dishes that Graham Smith used. I don't think you published anything relevant to that.
No, that was primarily his work. It was built specifically for, we wanted to push it to a higher frequency, both because of the evident unsatisfactoriness of the ionosphere at 80 megahertz, mm-hmm. where the original array was, and because its electrical center was much better defined. You see, in this measurement of declination by the periodicity of the interference pattern, you require to know the spacing.
Right.
Now, an array, a phased array of dipole, or dipoles in phase, can have imperfections in which the electrical centre is displaced along it. And that comes in first order as an error in declination.
Mm-hmm.
So the higher frequency gets to the ionosphere, and B, something which has had a much more definite electrical centre was the right thing. We had these dishes available to us, and this seemed the right way of going about making, the first astrometric instrument.
Right. Now, and was this phase switched? I can't remember.
Oh, yes.
That was the first instrument to be so?
No, I think this long Michelson thing was...
That was also... Switched. Okay, that's...
Well, phase switching was written up when? 19...
Yes, that was... 52.
Well, that was a sort of a Sowell Royal Society write-up.
Right.
So it was in use sometime before then, I think. This certainly didn't start with phase switching, because, you see, this record is not a phase switch one. But I'm pretty sure that by the time we built the 210 megahertz thing...
Right, alternately in phase and in anti-phase.
Ah, yes, that's
right.
Yes.
Can you tell me about how that idea came about?
Basically, I think the point was that we realized that you're trying to measure something small in the presence of something large of identical characteristics electrically. And you've just got to do something which changes the thing you want and doesn't change the thing you don't want, or vice versa. The switching against a noise source was one such thing, where whatever you did didn't affect the receiver noise, and therefore receiver noise could be eliminated, apart from the ordinary noise it produces. The next problem, which came up, is evident from the picture in there, is that if you're going to get sources very weak, then obviously you're limited by this thing not overloading the system, And therefore that limits what you can see on this record.
Right.
So if you could get rid of that as well, and one clear way is to use such a to switch to the alternate in and out phase, which will not affect anything which is large compared with the
right, you're saying the constant offset is what you're referring to.
Yes. Well, it isn't only the constant offset, it's the gains of things as well, again, you see. But before we had the first order receiver gain coming, now we've got all the gain of the post detector thing still present as a deflection, which can vary by small amounts because there isn't all that much gain, but it's still an important variation. But the real thing is to have something which gets rid of the thing you don't want right at the beginning.
Right, right.
And therefore, it was a fairly easy modification to make the switch, put in a half wave phase between the two elements and cut out the diode, the noise diode.
Really, one could say that the original Michelson interferometer back in 46 was also in the same sort of reasoning that you were trying to detect something small in the presence of something large.
Oh, yes, sure, it was. I mean, we knew that all the sun's radiation was going to be very small compared with the sunspot radiation. We didn't know how small. In fact, it would have been quite difficult to detect with a telescope we had, only a few dipoles each.
There's a story about the acquisition of the Würzburg dishes, which I've heard in the hallway, so to speak. I'd like to hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Could you tell me that story?
Uh-huh. Well, I knew the existence of these. They were brought over at the end of the war and went down to the Royal Aircraft Establishment to be assessed. They were fetched over from, one of us came from Holland, I forget where the other came from. And we knew of the existence of these. I knew the existence of these. And so we got agreement that we could have them. And so we went down to arrange for their transport. But found they'd unfortunately just been sold to a scrap metal merchant, which was sad. But we drove round to see the scrap metal merchant. He was a very nice chap. He was a very nice guy. He asked what he wanted them for. He said he wanted for scientific research. You can have them.
Oh.
I like science.
I see.
So then we're in a bit of a fix because gifts to the University of Cambridge have to be, a thing has to be recited in the Senate House in Latin. We weren't quite sure how I would translate all this stuff about German radar sets. However, good. The problem was solved because we swapped him a big German trailer, which we'd also picked up some other stuff on. We didn't want the trailer. So we all parted happily. He gave us for tea.
I see. Did you finally have to go through the procedures in the university?
No, because the straight exchange, you see, barter. We'd given them a trailer.
Oh, I see. That was the
reason. That solved this problem.
I see. Okay. Now, having the 1C survey and seeing that it worked, you've already mentioned that it was obvious that you had to get some outside funding. Could you just tell me about how that proceeded?
Well, here, Ratcliffe was an enormous help in making a strong case for us. He, I think, had really realized, probably in advance of a lot of people not actually in the game, that this was going to be an important field. And so he helped make our case to the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, it was then called, now the SRC. And we put up the case, presenting the evidence that we got so far on these things. And, of course, before we put the grant up, we designed an instrument which would have considerably greater collecting power and element resolving power. And we decided to go to a four-element system because it allowed you various possibilities in using interferometric techniques in various ways by cross-connecting them in a phase switch, measuring the phase difference and relative amplitudes of all four connected in different phasings. There were various possibilities of getting accurate declinations, which clearly the periodicity method was not satisfactory, it fell off at low decks.
Right.
So we designed that and designed it in some detail with a local little engineering firm. It seemed to be you could make a reflecting surface very cheaply by stretching wires across parabolic frames, which are parabolic frames are virtually two-dimensional structures with stretched wire filling up the third dimension, and this has very low windage. Stretched wires are much better than mesh, but you only needed stretched wires for one polarization. So it all seemed a very practical way of making it, so we got the design fairly well developed and costed, and put in this application for, I think it was £6,400,
mm-hmm.
It was $14,000 at the time, and that was granted, and we got ahead and built that.
And how long did it take to build?
Oh, it took about a year to build.
And having built it, you began with what became the 2C survey?
Well, the notorious 2C survey was what came out of it first, and that what we did wrong was to try and analyze it too deep. And as a result, the overlapping of images gave too many weak sources. But I think I'd like to make it quite clear that when we presented the case that the distribution of sources in depth didn't seem compatible with the uniform distribution, we were sufficiently worried about the analysis of these faint sources that we invented this alternative method, the PFD analysis, mm-hmm. which was at the time, as it still is, entirely independent of this overlapping image problem. It's dependent, as we realized, on the noise of the system, which is quite small, but it did give an absolutely unambiguous answer that the source distribution was not, in fact, obeying a three-house power law. And the first time we ever made any public statement, publication about the distribution source, we always said that we have confirmed this effect by the statistical method of analysis. Well, unfortunately, nobody understood the method, if they even read the papers, which they probably didn't. And as a consequence, you know, 2C is mud, and the conclusions from 2C are also mud. And that was not, in fact, really fair, right. Because this other method was put forward right from the beginning. We never put the source counts from 2C alone as an argument that there was something funny happening.
But I think it would be fair to say, though, that if one looks at those papers now, that was the main emphasis was log n, log s, and PFD was sort of back it up rather than the other way around.
No, they had a lecture, which was the first time this was talked about, that the two are presented as alternative ways of doing it.
Okay. Why do you think it was that people were reluctant to look into PFD enough, or did they look into it and have objections to it?
It's fairly complicated. I mean, it is a fairly difficult statistical problem. I mean, you can do it either by a sort of a crude Monte Carlo type procedure, which is tedious, or you can do it analytically, which Peter Shor eventually did, and improved it all precisely. And then Tony Hewish actually applied it in much more detail than it had been done before. But it was, well, let me just get the... Well, that's the source counts themselves, and that's the other thing.
So looking at the Halley lecture now.
And here's the probability distribution of amplitude D of the recorded trace, and these are this is the experimental curve, the hatched bit, and these are experimental curves with spatial density. Well, actually, the ordinary one. What is that might mean? It's important, firstly, with any instrumental other activity, it might give rise to an apparent excess of faint sources.
Yeah, I've noted here that you did not explicitly mention the concept of confusion and so forth. You must have been aware of it.
Well, certainly well, or he wouldn't have invented the system.
Right, I mean, that was the motivation for the PFD.
No, it doesn't actually explicitly say that, does it?
Right.
Well, the other paper wasn't a lot far behind, actually.
The Bakarian lecture? Scheuer?
No, it wasn't that one.
Was it Scheuer, Ryle and Scheuer you were thinking of, or?
What was that called?
Well, that was the one interpreted to, see, Proceedings of the Royal Society. I don't have the title here. I don't think I have that one. 55, the same time as the... Here it is. I think that's the one.